The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in things that never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. And I am so happy that we are together. Welcome, all you heroic men enduring the frigid days of winter, going to work early every morning, taking care of business, and doing what your head tells you to do when your head tells you it must be done. You men who ignore your heart's desire to indulge the body's seductive whisper, and instead you boldly heed the clarion call of responsibility to those you are strong enough to support and brave enough to care for. You are the army of the righteous. You are the noble knights defending the fortress of civilization against the hungry hordes of scheming and surging savages trying to invade and conquer what you and your fathers have built, knowing that even in its wrecked ruins, they will live better than in anything they could ever hope to build for themselves. Only you stand between the nightmare of socialistic slavery and the bright hope of tomorrow. And you beautiful and brave women, resisting government's treacherous proposal to marry it rather than accepting the ring of one clear-eyed man dreaming of a shared future, you gorgeously courageous women, who smilingly and graciously carry the load of work, marriage, and family, inspiring your man to greatness and nurturing your young ones to moral maturity as well as physical. Yes, you men and women who do all this and more, you men and women who have done all this, yes, you are the natural audience for the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. You are the audience I devotedly serve, recognizing that every day that I can bring you the helpful, life-affirming insights of ancient Jewish wisdom, well, that is a day of privilege for me. It is indeed my honor to serve you all and my delight to welcome you to another episode of the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. Yes, that's right. The only show in the entire digital universe that reveals how the world really works. That's right. And one of the ways that the world really works is on facts, not feelings. I listened the other day. I was in a hotel room in Philadelphia, and a Hollywood performer, a woman, was talking about her ghastly experiences at the hands of an entertainer, and I just want to make clear, right? She went out with him. She willingly went back to his apartment. She concedes that she willingly took off her clothes. She concedes that she willingly serviced him. And when he wanted to proceed further, she said no, and she got up and left. And she is a victim. That's right. She is a victim of the male culture, and so on and so forth. All of this is stuff you've heard, and you don't need your rabbi to rehash things you already know. But then she came up with something that not only caught my ear, but made me whip out my little pack of 3x5 cards quicker than a sheriff whipped out his six-shooter in the good old days, I mean the bad old days of the Wild West. That's right. As you devoted and regular listeners know, I not only carry, but I also recommend you carry a pile of 10 or 12, depending on your creativity, maybe more, 3x5 index cards held together with a rubber band. You just keep them in your pocket and make sure every morning you've got some fresh ones. Every night, make sure you take them out and transfer anything you wrote on them to some sort of action item. You move it to where something will be. In other words, this is an idea collector. As things occur to you during the day, it might be nothing more than the name of a person you want to follow up with. It might be the idea of a product or a service you can deliver. Whatever it is, I pulled that out. And on the top card, and I always have a blank one on top. As soon as I've used it, I move it to the bottom of the pile. And I wrote down, compassion is an action, not a feeling. And I said that because she then continued after this sad recount of her horrible experiences of being barbarically traumatized by this insensitive and boorish male. She said, well, some good has come out of it. I can say that I feel more compassionate than I ever have before. And I thought to myself, what a trivialization of a profound human characteristic. You feel more compassionate than you ever did before. What does that mean exactly? And I realized that it was another symptom of the extent to which we have become a culture of feeling instead of facts. Now, there are times you have to recognize that. When my wife said, you always drop cigar ash on the carpet, the incorrect, although accurate, response is a response based on facts. I could have said, well, you know, we've been married for 7 years, and I smoke about 3 or 4 cigars a week, and if I always drop the ash on the carpet, that would amount to approximately 29 pounds of ash that has fallen on the carpet. And I just don't think that you have swept away 29 pounds of ash, do you? At which point she bursts into tears. And the fault is mine, not hers. Because you have to know that certain times a person is expressing feelings, not facts. She might use factual mention, but what she wanted was an empathetic response to the feeling expressed, which is that I lack consideration and I don't care about how the living room carpet looks, and so on and so forth. And let it all be said that the foregoing example was fabricated entirely out of whole cloth. No part of it ever happened, but you get the idea. But generally speaking, we've become a culture of feelings trumping absolutely everything. And that's why it is that I periodically point out that if I am talking to you, whether it's through this venue or anywhere else, and your response is, I'm offended at what you said, that is not necessarily an indictment of me. It might be an indictment of you. Maybe you're just too thin-skinned. Because if we're going on your feelings, and then when somebody says, I'm offended, that's shorthand for saying, I am feeling offended, right? That's a very different statement from saying, you've just made an offensive statement. That would be a better way to go, because we can then say, let's look at it. You think I've made an offensive statement. Let's look and see. First of all, is it true? Then we can discuss whether a true statement can be offensive. Yeah, true statements could be offensive. Truth is not a defense against offensiveness. Okay, fine. If I really did say something offensive, I want to apologize, and I hope you'll accept it. But if I didn't say something offensive, the fact that you felt offended is neither here nor there. It's certainly nothing that I should be worried about, but it's something you should certainly be worried about. Feeling is an enormous problem when that trumps fact in our human interactions. Look, compassion is nothing to do with feelings. It is how you act. You tell me, young lady, that you are now a more compassionate person. Tell me how. Tell me what you've done in the last day, week, month. Tell me how this compassion manifests itself, because that is the only form of compassion that means anything whatsoever. So the trend continues into other areas as well. It moves into the areas where we dismiss what people say, we dismiss what people think, by labeling them things like racist, sexist, anti-Semite. And we use those words in a way that suggests the conversation is now closed. Everything you say, think, or even are has just been utterly discredited, because you are a racist, you're a sexist, you're an anti-Semite, you're a homophobe. Really? Is that correct? Just why it is not correct, we'll take a look at as soon as we come back after this quick break. But as usual, I like to encourage commercial interaction. You'll remember last week's show was technically on masturbation, but in reality, it was about human connection. And one of the points I made is that each and every one of us, particularly when young, have to decide whether our sexuality is going to be expressed through our aloneness or through our connection. And recognizing that we are human beings created to connect, and that there are two vehicles for connection that we've been given: sex and money. Sex is the engine of connection that creates family, and money is the engine of connection that creates society. And I spoke about that and explained how that worked last week. And money, the transfer of money between individuals, is what builds a relationship. In other words, a transaction is something that adds to the existence of a relationship. Obviously, relationship must precede transaction. There is nothing more unpleasant than a voracious and venal-eyed man pursuing a transaction before there is even a relationship. Think about that. There's something profoundly unpleasant about a voracious and venal man trying to pursue a transaction before he has built a relationship. Think about that, both in your professional and business enterprises and among those you encounter. At any rate, the mouth as a vehicle of communication and relationship can be used effectively or ineffectively. And our culture, with its enormous emphasis on leisure, relaxation, and entertainment, tends to produce less articulate communication. And so in an audio CD that I would like to sell to you on the basis that we now have a relationship after all. Hopefully you've spent 11 or 12 minutes listening to me already. I would call that at least the beginnings of a relationship. I now feel free to pursue a transaction, because here is a way we can benefit one another. I benefit you by bringing you specific, practicable, applicable information that you can use to enhance your communication effectiveness, and in exchange, you pay me for those services, which enables me to get cornflakes for breakfast. And so head over to the website. It's called RabbiDanielLappin.com. And right there, you will look for an audio program called The Perils of Profanity. You Are What You Say, The Perils of Profanity. And here's the best part. You can download it right now. Get it in digital form, giving you an hour of very tightly packed and condensed useful information on effective communication, The Perils of Profanity, and it is available for an immediate digital download for a very reduced price of $5. So that is not a whole lot of money for information that you probably would not be able to get, well, I think it's fair to say, anywhere else in the digital universe, the entire digital universe. All right, before I get too carried away, let's stop for a break. And as soon as we come back, we'll take a look at racism, anti-Semitism, sexism, homophobia, and all the other ways we have of silencing dissenting voices. I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Be right back.
Ancient solutions to modern problems. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin, and Retirement Curveball is a book by a finance expert that I respect, Dr. Tom McPhee. Whether you are thinking about retirement, are already retired, or have never given the big R even a thought, now is the time to welcome the contents of this book into your mind. The book is filled with compelling aha moments and will motivate you to make some highly effective changes in how you manage your money and your life. I know Dr. Tom McPhee and his terrific book, Retirement Curveball, and I do recommend it. Get the book at retirementcurveball.com or on Amazon.
Rabbi Daniel Lappin returns with more of how the world really works on the Blaze Radio Network On Demand.
Hello, everybody, and we're back here on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where I, your rabbi, remind you that the more that things change, the more we need to depend on those things that never change. And one of the things that's changing at a frantic pace is a distortion of the English language. You see, the word homophobe, suggesting that the person at whom the slur is being flung is somehow petrified of homophobe. Well, homo means man. Well, what exactly does it mean? Oh, you're frightened of homosexuals. Is that what it is? Or you're frightened of homosexuality. Which is it? Well, again, easy to solve if we stick to facts, if we get right down to it. And that is that we human beings are not animals. We are a distinctly separate species from the rest of the animal world. And one of the ways in which I think it's unarguable that we are separate species, or a separate species, is that it makes perfect sense to define an animal in purely physical terms. And so I can say what sort of color dog I want, right? I'm looking for a white German Shepherd. It's very rare. I don't want an albino German Shepherd. I want a white German Shepherd. And a long line of sellers can form outside my home, each one eager to sell me a German Shepherd. But unless anyone has a white one, I'm not buying. I want a white one. And while many people may discourage me and people may say, no, white ones aren't any good. The fact is that what I'm saying is perfectly rational. For reasons that are my own, I want a white German Shepherd, and that is the primary distinction of this German Shepherd. I would never say, I want a German Shepherd that believes in democracy. I want a German Shepherd that has accumulated some wealth. Right? We'd never say that. The color of the dog is fine. You might say that you want to purchase something of a certain weight, right? You want 5 pounds of sugar. Perfectly fine. You might even say that you are looking for a 3 pound lobster. I don't know how much lobsters weigh or how much of it you eat. I don't know. But regardless, makes perfect sense when you talk about animals to define them in purely physical terms. But it doesn't make any sense to define human beings in physical terms. And so nobody would say, I am looking for a human being of a certain color. No. If you're looking to hire somebody in your firm, then you are looking to hire somebody with certain skills, with a certain outlook, with a belief in hard work and dedication, somebody who has loyalty and integrity. Those are the things you want. If somebody comes to tell you that they have a candidate with green hair, right, it's irrelevant. That's not what I'm interested in. You got somebody with purple skin or yellow. It doesn't matter. That's not the issue, because with human beings, physical characteristics are very secondary. You know, unless you are looking to hire a swimsuit model or you're looking to find a professional heavyweight boxer, in those circumstances, you're looking for somebody with certain physical characteristics. I understand. But in the overwhelming bulk of human interaction, when it comes to human beings, physical distinctions are not what we're looking for. And now, all of a sudden, this basic principle that has undergirded Western thinking for a very long time has been turned on its head, and we are told that this individual, well, his entire identity is the result of his sexual preference. Do you see how ridiculous this is? I mean, can you imagine anybody walking around with a T-shirt that says masturbator, going back to last week's show? Right? It's absurd. Well, why should it be absurd? If somebody else has a T-shirt that says proud homosexual, then why would somebody else not have a T-shirt that says proud masturbator? Or somebody else might say proud lover of blonde women. In other words, if we're going to start distinguishing ourselves by our preferences for sexual sensation, really? It makes absolutely no sense at all. And, you know, imagine a Jew walking into synagogue with a shirt that says, proud member of Pork Eaters of America, right? I think it's possible that the members of that synagogue might conceivably tap him on the shoulder after the end of the worship service and say, by the way, you know what? We don't really care whether you eat pork or not. That's between you and God. We welcome you here at the synagogue. We're happy you're here. But once you put it on your T-shirt, well, that's kind of a different thing, because you're now proclaiming yourself in public to be a proud violator of the entire moral system that brings us here in the first place. We don't all adhere to every detail of that moral system, but we all recognize it for what it is, an overarching moral system, part of God's message to humanity. And how each person relates to that is his own business. But when you wear a T-shirt that says, proud member of Pork Eaters of America, or proud pork eater, you kind of change the dynamic here a little bit. You walk in with a T-shirt that says, proud homosexual, we don't really care how you arrange your sexual relationships and how you prefer to obtain sexual sensation. We don't really care. That's between you and your creator. And we're happy to welcome you here. But once you proclaim that as your essential identity, then you put us in a very difficult position. Because any literate human being acknowledges that the word sin is very easy to define. The word sin simply means something prohibited by God in the Bible. That's what a sin is. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to agree with me on that. You may say, you know what, I don't care that it's a sin, it's what I like doing. And good luck to you, that's your autonomous decision. You have the right to make that decision. But I have a right to view it as a sin, because the book I look to for guidance terms that conduct a sin. However, it is conduct, not identity. That's the point. It's conduct, not identity. And so the fact that you might be a Jew who eats pork when you go out for Chinese food every Sunday night, that doesn't define your identity. If somebody walks around saying, I'm a rich man, that's ridiculous. To define your identity by what you possess in the bank, that's not who we are. So how do we define our identities? We define our identities by our beliefs. That's what does it. That's the most important thing. And that's why it is that you happen to be carrying and well known to be a courier for the diamond industry, and your ship gets shipwrecked, and you and one other person get washed up on the shore of a desert island, and everybody knew that you were carrying diamonds, and even now there's a pouch around your waist. You need to know only one thing about the person who's been saved on the desert island with you. You don't need to know how much calculus he knows. You don't need to know whether he understands the history of the so-called Dark Ages, which weren't dark at all. Or you don't need to know if he knows how to operate a numerically controlled machine tool. You really only need to know his belief system. And based on what his belief system is, you can then decide whether you can ever risk going to sleep. It's as simple as that. Belief systems really matter. But physical characteristics, why would we label somebody a homosexual simply because of what he chooses to do? Why is that more of an identity than a blonde woman lover, or more of an identity than a masturbator, right? We don't give those things as identities, and I don't accept that homosexual is an identity. Homosexual behavior is a conduct. And I also don't believe that once somebody has engaged in that behavior, that decrees that that's all they can and will do for the rest of their lives. I don't believe that's true. You know, you may disagree, but I'm just telling you what I believe, because this is called the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. And I think that its primary interest is the things I believe rather than the things that that I am. And so what about anti-Semitism? What about racism? Well, again, let me explain. It has to go back to action, not identity. Action, not identity. Facts, not feelings. And precision in communication is enormously helpful. There are mealy-sounding words. There are phrases that avoid commitment. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just listen to a member of the United States Congress, either the House of Representatives or the Senate. Just listen to how most politicians speak. And you will learn non-committal phrases. You will learn flowery phrases that mean absolutely nothing. You will learn, if you make them your teachers, you will learn how to talk for 3 minutes, and at the end of which, you've said absolutely nothing. You've made no commitment, you've expressed no firm belief, nothing at all. because there is a lot of that kind of communication going on in society. That is precisely the opposite of the way one communicates for the most success in social interaction, including romantic, and in business and financial interaction, where you shoot for maximum precision, maximum clarity, and actually, yes, maximum commitment, a very clear enunciation of where you stand. Learning how to communicate like that has enormous value in terms of improving your life. You know, I've often pointed out on the show in the past that if I asked you to think of one thing you could do that would destroy your life, the ideas flood into your mind, don't they? You don't need a minute to think of one idea that could dramatically destroy your life. In a minute, I could think of 20 things I could do. Well, certainly 8 things I could do that would immediately destroy my life. And you could too. How about if I gave you a minute to think of something that could dramatically improve your life? It's a lot harder, right? Because in general, the world that God built contains not only physical gravity, which causes any object in a vacuum to fall with an acceleration of 32 feet per second every second. The world also has a spiritual gravity, which tends to pull downwards, which means that it's much, much, much easier to destroy a car than to create one. It's much easier to knock down a building than it is to create and construct a building. And similarly, it is far easier to destroy your life than it is to improve it. But one thing that you could do to improve your life is to dramatically improve your fluency, your ability to pronounce words, your vocabulary, to articulate words. And how to do that? Well, the best advice of how to do that is captured in a 1-hour intense program that I want you to listen to not only once but several times. That's why it's not in a book, it's in a audio CD, so you can listen to it on numerous occasions. You can listen to it while commuting and exercising and walking the dog and anything else. And you can also download it right away. It's called The Perils of Profanity, and it is not all about profanity. It's all about the subtitle, which is You Are What You Speak, You Are What You Say. And if you go to my website at rabbidaniellappin.com for a small investment of $5, which I think you'll agree is not an amount that most of us need to think about extensively before spending, $5, download it right away. Well, not right away, because you're in the middle of listening to the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show podcast. But when you're done, just go to rabbidaniellappin.com, look for The Perils of Profanity, pay $5, download it, and you've got it there and then. Listen to it. If you follow only a small part, if you follow a half of its advice, you will find yourself speaking much more effectively within about 6 weeks. Seriously. Anyway, all of that is at rabbidaniellappin.com, Perils of Profanity, and I, your rabbi, back in just a moment.
Spilling ancient solutions for modern problems in the areas of family, faith, friendship, and finance. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network. Revealing how the world really works. This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin, on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and we are back here on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. Continuing on with an analysis of anti-Semitism. Should we take a look at that? I must say that although I am Jewish, although I am certainly aware of the pogroms in the 12th century that resulted in the Jews being expelled from Britain, I'm aware of pogroms throughout the Middle Ages and all the way up to the 20th century that killed Jews and destroyed property owned by Jews in Europe. And in spite of all that, I would with one wave of my wand utterly abolish the word anti-Semitism, certainly in the United States of America. Why? because it has become a club with which to bludgeon dissenters from left-wing liberal orthodoxy into complete silence. Let me explain to you what I mean. Going back a number of years, when the American Alliance of Jews and Christians, and by the way, you can learn more about that if you wish at aajc.org, American Alliance of Jews and Christians. It's an organization I played a part, a small part, in founding. It was founded by a group of Jewish and Christian business people, men and women, Jewish and Christian, brothers and sisters, who felt that the topic I had been lecturing on for about a year, namely that Western civilization could only be saved by Jews and Christians, representatives of the civilizations of the Bible, standing shoulder to shoulder. That organization, the American Alliance of Jews and Christians, back then, one of the things that brought it about was that let me give you an example. This happened in a town in the United States, in the southern United States, where two Jews ran for two empty spots on the local school board, the local school district. And being a southern town, and some of you may be surprised to hear this, but there was enormous warmth to the descendants of Abraham, and the town immediately, even though these two individuals did not have lengthy prior resumes of public service, I love that phrase, nonetheless, they were elected in case of one, first elected office ever, in the other, second, and there they were on the school board. So, very conservative town, Christian-based town. And what did these two Jewish members of the school board do? Well, very first thing they did was introduce sex ed, right? Something which the school board had rightly resisted up till then. And then they started pushing for condom distribution in middle school and upwards. Okay, I'm serious. And so at that point, members of the school board, parents who had children in the schools, and pastors all began to agitate for the removal of these two Jewish members and to have them voted out at the next election, which is exactly what happened. Well, needless to say, they immediately shrieked anti-Semitism and tried to bring the fury of the New York-based Jewish establishment down on the heads of the small town. And that was when I realized that there just really needed to be a counter voice to this, hence the American Alliance of Jews and Christians. Hence, I went down to this town and made an extremely loud proclamation that this is not anti-Semitism, that it is important to know that the equation Judaism equals liberalism is completely false, that I utterly reject the notion that being a good Jew and being a good member of the Democratic Party are synonymous, that those two things are exactly the same, and that hence anybody who opposes extreme liberalism is somehow anti-Jewish is a notion that I vehemently and vociferously reject. And, I was thanked by a number of people. I was thanked by the I felt very, very gratified. I felt I had done something really more useful than I had done for months and months and months. I was gratified about that. And that began a period where I consistently and regularly would make trips to places where pastors and political leaders were being accused of anti-Semitism when they stood up to the excesses of modern liberalism. In other words, by claiming that the values of Judaism are inherently conservative, not liberal, and it was an utter distortion of Judaism to call it liberal, and therefore the idea that if you oppose liberalism, you're somehow being anti-Semitic. Anyway, all very clear, but it was bad stuff, what was going on. And what the problem was, again, was the reason that when I'm in charge, I'm going to utterly eliminate the word anti-Semitism from America's political vocabulary is because what it lets you do is label somebody in a way that they have to spend all their energies trying to defend themselves against, and you can't do it. Because when I proclaim you to be an anti-Semite, I am making a statement about something that is in your heart, which obviously I don't know. But it doesn't stop me charging you with that slur, and you have absolutely no way to deny it. That is the evil inherent in the word anti-Semitism. So somebody has said to me, well, what are you going to say about real anti-Semitism? Look, I believe in freedom of belief. And that means that if somebody wants to believe bad things about Judaism, you know what? In a free country that has worked pretty well for 200 years until we started some of the nonsense, people were allowed to believe and think whatever they want. And if somebody wants to believe that Jews have horns, fine, let them. In exactly the same way that I don't get all hot and bothered when people believe that the world is flat. Right? Really, life is too short to worry about people with weird beliefs. Let them believe whatever they want. They want to believe anything about Jews, let them, it's fine. Where I object is where it becomes actions against Jewish bodies or Jewish property. But there are already laws for that. Those laws are called assault, vandalism. You don't need anything else. I strongly resisted the dreadful hate crime legislation that was introduced under the Clinton administration. I'm pretty sure it was. I'm sorry, I should have checked that before I said it. But hate crime legislation, whoever it was under, I opposed vigorously because it's not needed and will only be used to suppress freedom of expression. And so I would absolutely do away with the term anti-Semitism, because it's a way of charging somebody with something that there is no way they can defend themselves against, because how would they prove? And it's pathetic sometimes to hear people doing it. Well, I have many Jewish friends. It's like people saying, oh, yeah, I got many black friends, when the other parallel charge comes up, which I'll come to in just a moment. Yes, I know you say those pathetic things because there is no other way to adequately defend yourself. And even that is not a defense. So therein lies the enormous problem when we start talking about identity instead of behavior. Right, you are an anti-Semite. Stop it already. Why didn't you just identify where that person behaved badly? Did he strike a Jew because the person is a Jew? Did he take his property or damage his property because he's a Jew? Fine, let's deal with that. Behavior can be dealt with because it's fact-based. But when you start attacking people because of what you charge is their feelings, no. That is a calamity waiting to happen. Racism, stop it already. Talk about actions. Somebody behaved badly to a person. He attacked a person because the person is white and the person who did the attacking isn't. That is a form of racism. But don't we have laws for that already? We don't have to say, oh, you're a racist. You attacked that white person because you're black and he's white. Yeah, I'm sure that happens. Fine. So charge them. Put them in jail. As far as I'm concerned, execute them. You attacked somebody who's black because he's black and you're white? Fine. Let's not talk about what's in your heart. Let's just talk about what you did. It's unarguable. It's not a feeling. It's not an identity. It's a fact. The idea of being able to create a diversion, of being able to damage a person's ability to go about his life because you charge him as a racist or as an anti-Semite. How about a sexist? What is that supposed to mean? We've got to talk about actions, not feelings, not identities. That is the only way that this society can function. It's an enormous level of civilization to have reached, to have gotten to this point where we fight with ballots instead of bullets. It's an enormous achievement of a society to get to the point where people may say anything and believe anything. But it's only when actions take place that we legislate. That is great. It's wonderful to indict somebody because of their thoughts. It's ridiculous. What somebody thinks about somebody else of a different color, it's their business. It's their business. Actions are different. Speech is so important. To be able to speak persuasively, to be able to speak in a way that has people listen. I mentioned a little bit earlier in the program, and I'm sure you've seen this, right? Where you sometimes at a gathering, sometimes it's a business meeting, a social meeting. Other times it's just an informal get together. But have you noticed that there's sometimes people speak, and people then everyone else sort of shuts up and listens to them. What is that authority that they carry? Well, I'll tell you part of it. I talk about in the audio program Perils of Profanity that I want you to buy, and part of it is the idea of avoiding phrases, words, language that is heavy but meaningless. Lots of words, sometimes big words, but at the end of a few sentences, you realize the person has just been enjoying the sound of his voice. It doesn't mean anything. That would be when people don't pay attention. When people do pay attention is when the words are selected to be words that actually do firmly and unequivocally express a thought. And learning how to do that is not hard, but it just requires a little bit of consistent effort doing some very specific things that I lay out in this audio program, Perils of Profanity, You Are What You Speak, and you may download it. It's so important, it really is. And honest to goodness, there is a way to market that, and a lot of people have approached me about internet marketing, etc., etc., and this would be marketed as a sort of $99 program or $220 program, but you can download it now for $5. And one of the things that worries me is that because we haven't engaged in high-pressure internet marketing techniques, you're going to think to yourself, not you specifically, but people in general, $5, you know, what's the value? You get what you pay for, right? So this is really, really invest in something meaningful for only $5. Well, it's a discount price, usually a little over $10. But still, it is important, and its importance and value far outweighs the cost. So go to RabbiDanielLappin.com. The Perils of Profanity is the program, and the website RabbiDanielLappin.com is also where you can comment, send me notes. I love to hear from you, and I do take into account pretty much everything that I read from listeners to this show. Be back with you in just a moment. Don't go away.
There's still more to come from Rabbi Daniel Lappin on demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Stupid internet stuff.
Huh, click here for free. Oh, I got a virus.
Smart internet stuff.
It's one thing to say you're disciplinarians, you're not going to let them play with other people, whatever. You're not. You're crazy. And don't claim to be a part of my religion. You know, I'm hesitant when I call people out that I say, that's not Christian behavior, you're not doing it or whatever, because there are differences. You've got to work out your own salvation. This is not faith. This is not humane. You, parents, are animals.
The Morning Blaze with Doc Thompson.
Weekdays 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern on the Blaze Radio Network.
Welcome back to Rabbi Daniel Lappin On Demand on the Blaze Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for being back with the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show, where your rabbi continues to reveal how the world really works. And one of the ways the world really works is that there really are bandits and brigands in this wonderful world of ours. There always have been, and there always will be. If you took yourself off with your spouse to a remote, isolated desert island, and in this little thought experiment were we to stipulate benign weather and ample food and no belligerent species of two-legged or four-legged variety on the island, and as time goes by, your tribe thrives and grows, and two people turn into five people, who turn into 20 people, etc., etc., and we gaze upon this ongoing thought experiment through clandestine surveillance equipment over hundreds and hundreds of years, we will eventually find a breakaway group from your tribe who will become predators on the law-abiding members of your tribe. It's going to happen. It's going to be. And so it always is. This is true on the school ground, the playground at the schoolyard. This is true in the world of business. And yes, it is true in the world of geopolitics. There will always be. How do I know that? Well, obviously from the Bible. And but it doesn't matter, because you probably know it as well. It's a fundamental truth about the human condition. We are not euphoric about the future. We are not mindless. We're cautiously optimistic, but we do recognize human nature. By contrast, of course, the left in general believes in the ultimate mutability of human nature, and that somehow, over the course of time, with the correct treatment, with the correct social planning, with the correct government programs paid for by confiscatory high rates of taxation, we will eventually change human nature and make sure that there are no criminals, there are no bandits, there are no brigands, there are no bad players in society at all. And those that are there only because of the lingering effects of capitalism, sexism, racism, anti-Semitism, etc., etc., etc. But all of that stuff is tiresome. Far more interesting is the conversation I had with a young man, 14 years old, and is taught by teachers in a GIC. Do I still have to tell you what a GIC is? Well, I do. You know why? Because thanks to so many of you who actively promote this show, we have new listeners all the time. Yes, that's right. And so, without question, there are probably, looking at our numbers, there's probably 300 people listening right now who've never heard the show before. And so, when you hear me speak of a GIC, you are baffled and mystified. But there's no reason for such confusion. A GIC is a government indoctrination camp. That's right. It's a government indoctrination camp. This 14-year-old boy is given his perspective on reality. He is provided a worldview courtesy of a GIC, a government indoctrination camp, otherwise known as a public school. And the I had asked him what he thought about President Trump. a question almost certain to evoke profound feelings and deep emotional responses almost wherever that question is phrased. And so I consequently carefully choose to whom to phrase that question. But I did to this young man, and he told me that he was not an enthusiast of the president. And I asked him why, and he thought for a few moments and said, well, I think he's probably going to get us into a war. Okay. With who? Well, he was a little less certain about this. Perhaps he hadn't been paying attention while his teacher was propagandizing on this particular point. But we spoke for a little while, and I asked him how many countries in the world he was familiar with. I asked him which countries did he think had nuclear capacity. I asked him if he thought Canada did. I asked him if he thought the United Kingdom did. He was certain that neither of those countries possessed nuclear capacity. And I asked him if he would be any more nervous about Iran possessing nuclear weapons than about Canada possessing nuclear weapons. And his response was that nuclear weapons were nuclear weapons. It didn't really matter who had them. They were just bad all around. And so because he is somebody who I care about, and he's somebody who cares about my opinion, we spoke a little bit more, and I tried to convey to him the idea that sometimes not fighting a war can be far more dangerous than fighting a war. I took him back to December the 11th, 1941. This is 4 days after Pearl Harbor. And a very strange thing happened at that point. Japan has declared war on the United States just after launching the attack on Pearl Harbor. And 4 days later, Adolf Hitler declares war on the United States in Berlin. Von Ribbentrop called the American representative and notified him that as of this date, December the 11th, 1941, the German government considers it, the government of the Third Reich considers itself to be at war with the United States of America. What might have happened had Hitler not done that? Well, of course, nobody can tell. It's very similar to a question which is not only asked, but books have been written about it extensively, talking about what would have happened if Winston Churchill would have listened to Chamberlain and would have listened to Lord Halifax and gone to Hitler and said, let's talk about peace, right? Let's work out a way that England can continue to exist without taking more German blood and more British blood. Let's end this war with some kind of understanding. And Lord Earl Halifax, who had been doing nothing less than groveling at the feet of Hitler, would have gone for that, and many others would have gone for it as well. And the result would have been some kind of German control over England, if not a complete takeover of the institutions of English power. It certainly would have been regulating English institutions, and English people would then have been living under German authority. German language would certainly have been taught in British schools, etc., etc. But there were a lot of people who would have gone for that. The truth is that, in my mind, had Churchill joined with Halifax and with Chamberlain and with many of the other people who were pushing for that at right through the dark days of 1941, I'm quite sure that England would have gone for it. I mean, for a long time, Churchill literally carried the war on his shoulders, and there were many who charged him with loving war and being a warmonger. But what would have happened had they, in fact, gone for peace? It's worth thinking about. It's also worth thinking about what might have happened had Hitler not declared war on the United States. Is it possible? And let's also add to that little thought experiment the idea that in America, Roosevelt would not have declared war on Germany. He probably would have. And don't forget, back in the First World War, in 1917, America did come into the war. And so Hitler would not have been crazy to assume that America would eventually come in the war anyway. And by choosing his time, he was ahead of the game. Well, that proved to be the case because during the first 6 months of 1942, the Germans sunk. The U-boat war was prosecuted with devastating effectiveness. And the Germans sunk over 600 Allied ships, not military ships, but merchant shipping. Do you have any idea of what it means to lose 600 ships, all of which were packed full of war material for England and for Russia? Over 600 ships. And so during those first months, up till the fall of 1942, Hitler really was looking very good. People were saying, yeah, I guess he was right to declare war on Germany. Because until he declared war on Germany, he couldn't attack those German ships. Excuse me, he couldn't attack those American ships, which he did. And so he ruthlessly sent 600 ships, British and American, to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. The U-boats were really effective. But had Hitler not declared war, what might have happened? Is it possible that in reality, Germany then grows and becomes powerful? Our American support for Russia doesn't happen, because we want to stay out of the war, and so Germany eventually defeats Russia, and maybe even there would end up a sort of a Cold War, but not between America and Russia, but between America and the Third Reich. There would have been in total control of Europe. It would have been a German hegemony over Europe, not a Russian one. It's interesting to think about these and speculate about these things, but what Hitler did, a lot of people have said, oh, Hitler was crazy to declare war on America. No, he wasn't. He actually didn't have a choice because he fairly reasonably concluded that America would be in the war eventually, and rather than wait for America to come into the war when it was good and ready, by declaring war on America, he was able to do very well during those early months of 42. He basically got ahead of things. And so choosing your time to fight, when fighting looks as if it's going to become inevitable, choosing your time to fight is a whole lot better than waiting until you don't have a choice. This was one of the great lessons for those of you who have followed Churchill, as I have, those of you who read Churchill as I do, you will know that during the 1930s, this was exactly what Churchill was saying. He correctly predicted that the blood that would be spilt, English blood, the blood of the French, the blood of the Allies, the blood that would be spilt ultimately would be far, far greater than that would have been spilt had the Allies dealt with Germany earlier. There was a perfect opportunity. When Hitler violated the treaty ending World War I by retaking the Rhineland, Germany's industrial heart, that was an opportunity that was wasted. That was an opportunity that literally could have avoided World War II. How do I know? Because documentation that we now have access to from inside Germany, from inside the German high command, shows that Wehrmacht officers told Hitler, senior command said to Hitler, if you will march us back into the Rhineland, you will bring greater destruction to Germany. The Allies will come back and wipe us out. And Hitler said, don't worry, the weakness of the Western democracies can be depended upon. And he was absolutely right. But there is no question that had France and England and America immediately gone in, guns blazing, and said, back you get, out of the Rhineland, stick to the agreement we made with you. Documents now show that the Germans said and knew that if the Allies were in fact to have made a fuss when the Germans retook the Rhineland, that would have been the end of it. There would have been no World War II. The Germans would absolutely have quickly settled back down. Hitler would have been replaced. And, the Wehrmacht would have immediately dispatched him because he was so wrong. He told them to attack the Rhineland, and England and France and America would immediately come down on them, throw them out of the Rhineland. Well, without the Rhineland, they have no military capacity. And without Hitler, they would have resumed their role as Germany had been during the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. But it was a weakness and fear of war found in England. And yes, the World War I had left everybody battle scarred. There's no question about it. But there was very clear treaties. There was the Versailles Treaty at the end of World War I. There was the Locarno Treaty between England and France and Germany. I think that was 1925. And it established beyond a shadow of a doubt that there would be no German army in the Rhineland. It would be a demilitarized zone. Even the Allied armies would eventually withdraw. And failure to fight then made for a much higher cost later on. I'm no prophet, and I certainly pray for times of peace. But at the same time, I worry that the Obama administration's appeasement of Iran could well end up costing a lot of good blood. It could. I hope not. But it would have been so easy to solve early on and so hard to solve now. North Korea, again, policies that years and years ago were succeeding in destroying its capacity. Really effective sanctions under Bush, under Clinton. Dreadful failures, for which it's very possible that American blood will have to be spilt. And so I tried to explain to my young protege that these are very scary decisions. These are responsibilities that weigh so heavily on the shoulders of national leaders. But it is very important to remember that there are worse things than having to fight a war. Now, you all know how I felt about the squandering of blood and money in the war in Iraq, President Bush's adventure. You know what I thought about the futile attempts to bring Western democracy to the Middle East. Enough of that for now. One has to resist foolish wars, but that doesn't mean that all wars must be avoided. And that was what I tried to convey to my young friend. Well, folks, that is as far as we're going to go on today's show. And so until the wonderful opportunity I have to be together with you again next week, I wish you a week of good health and prosperity. Don't forget to get yourself a copy of Perils of Profanity over at RabbiDanielLappin.com. And until next week, I'm Rabbi Daniel Lappin. God bless you.
The Blaze on Demand.
This is Rabbi Daniel Lappin.